I remember a Superman coloring book that I was pretty into when I would visit my grandmother down in Florida. But yeah, they're always like, you know, on the dashboard of my dad's truck, you know, going to the beach or something, like Corn Nuts and comics.
Hey, thanks for listening. Well, we've been traveling a bunch for the last month. And last week we got back from Oregon, and I've just had my head down drafting the new novel. So on top of work, travel, and that, I have been quiet. I opted to not put out episodes while I was away because I couldn't handle the extra tasks. So this week's episode with Rico Renzi is a redemption episode, I guess, in some sense. Rico and I recorded this in December. So don't get too confused when we start talking about end of the year and Christmas recipes, et cetera, and so forth. You haven't lost your mind. I have been wrestling with the technical issues of this episode. We had some weird video glitch, which kicked Rico off, I think, like 8 times during the conversation. It kept recording on my end, so he would just disappear and then come back and back and forth like that. So if he sounds distracted for like the first half, maybe the first 2/3, it's because he was walking on thin ice. There was no rhyme or reason. It would just happen. You could tell he was getting frustrated by the whole thing, but he was a champ and we made it through. So that was tough because all these pieces were all chopped up. Then I couldn't get the recordings as individual tracks. So what I had to work with was one compressed, flattened file, so to speak, of audio. So I couldn't really control the levels, backgrounds, my inevitable talking over my wonderful guests. So, which is what I really try to get rid of in the post-production aspect. It's a really, really great conversation with someone whose contributions to comic books is actually pretty significant. And, you know, from a sort of a creative and a product and a collaborative fashion, Rico's just kind of been this really interesting personality for the last 25 years. He's a funny, funny guy. When he gets going, it's a show. So I hope you dig it because he's a really, really great person with a lot of interesting things to talk about. I hope we can have another conversation down the road, the two of us, with no technical issues, because it drives me nuts that I can't give you the perfectly clear conversation. He sounds like I'm talking to him from prison, which I'm pretty sure he wasn't in. Yeah, anyway, I enjoy. It's a really fun conversation with Rico Renzi.
There you are.
There it is.
There you are. And we can hear each other. This is a momentous event.
We did it.
Oh, man. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, man. Like, I don't know how it is for you, but like, it's just a mad rush to get to the end of the year, trying to get the whatever lingering projects that are there, because everybody disappears like from next week till mid-January. Yeah. And it's so hard to get anybody to sort of make any. And like our client who we were supposed to have like a call with like the other day, nowhere to be found. She's like, oh, I've been in the ER for, I don't know, eight or 9 hours. She was trying to rescue a cat and the cat bit her. So she ended up having to get like an IV and like tetanus shots and all this stuff. And she's like, I haven't slept for 24 hours. I'm like, okay, well, I mean, this sounds like a perfect time for me to get you to do some sign offs on things because you're weak. Are you just on the freelance hustle to like get as much done as you can so you don't have to work as long as you can?
Yeah, I don't really get to control it as much. It just seems like I'm gonna have two books due by the end of the year, and I only have a few pages from each. I've been waiting on a contract from a book publisher for months, and I just got it, just signed it. And then when I responded to the art director, she's like, oh, I'm out of office until next year. So I don't know if I'll get paid for that this year or next year. I don't know. And I don't know what's better. I don't know.
I know. I wish I was smart enough to know which is always better. I guess that's why I have an accountant, but I should probably speak to him.
Yeah.
So like, I know you for comic book stuff, but often when I, you know, see you on Instagram, you're like at a gallery event, like you did something and it's up somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm wondering like what the draw is for you, like doing the things that you're doing like in gallery work.
The gallery stuff is like more like real people, like people in the area, like connecting mm-hmm. with them. And, you know, I'm just an art fan in general. So seeing, you know, going to events and seeing what people have made and having my stuff in the show is kind of like, I've been in Charlotte, North Carolina since 2011, and I've had the like comics community, but I never really knew like the more fine art, like mm-hmm. gallery community. So I'm starting to get to know those people now, and actually putting on an annual show over there. So it's fun to do something different.
That's cool. I mean, because I see a lot of like what I would call like more traditional printmaking kind of work that you're doing in that venue. Is that what you're kind of viewing it as, or are you doing other type of?
Well, when I was first invited to one of the shows, I just did like a digital canvas print of mm-hmm. stuff that I had done, like, you know, modified for that format. And, but lately I've been into, gel plate printing, which is,
oh, wow.
Like, it's like a little like jelly pad that you can transfer something you've made, you know, elsewhere onto, and then layer different colors and textures and stuff behind it, and, you know, pull a print and then it's gone. Like it comes off the plate and that's it. So it's just a monoprint. So I've been kind of obsessing about doing those lately. So we just opened a show last weekend, and I have like four of those in the show.
I think I remember seeing those. Are they're like they lined up like next to each other, like the pieces, right?
Yeah.
That's so cool. I mean, that's a really interesting medium.
I have visual aids. I just made these today.
Oh, very cool.
Like the print is the green part, and then the purple part is the actual transfer paper that I used and some ink stuck to it. And so I just kind of tore it and put it on there.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I live, you know, my wife is a full-time contemporary fine artist. So I'm often going to some sort of thing, art event thing. And it's a really fun, listen, they're far more social and into having like the gathering events than the general comic book population, because there's just more of them, I think.
I go to these, and there's the opening, which is like a party, and then there's the after party. I don't usually go to those, but
yeah.
But yeah, they do it up.
Yeah, no, it's nice. And you know, we're members of different various museums in town, so you get to kind of have a group of people that you keep running into and talk with. I think it's like another one of those really interesting things that, like, I think if you work outside of what you do for your daily on something, I think it makes what you do for your daily better.
Yeah.
A bunch of different ways.
Yeah, I agree.
How do you find that who have helped your work?
I don't know. I've always kind of been like a sloppy designer type colorist. Like I've never really thought of myself as like just a colorist. I'm like mm-hmm. more of a color designer. So I've always you know, thrown stuff in, comics and covers. And I just did a Spider-Punk cover, and, you know, it was just a figure. And I, you know, did a bunch of letter set, like scanned background, torn up paper stuff to it. And it came out really cool.
That's cool. Yeah. And I, you know, you say that, and that's sort of kind of what I gravitated to when I first saw your work, like in person. I walked by and all I felt was, oh, this isn't like regular comic coloring, which I appreciate. And I, you know, I inundated you, I think, immediately with how it reminded me, at least heuristically. I was going to say heuristically, but that's not the right word, but by the hues, similar to my person, you know, my favorite artist being Michael Golden and his color selection, where there are these really interesting pairings and lots of 100%, but in like, in ways that you don't normally see 100%. And I thought that was like, it was really interesting to see that. And then like you kind of do layer it up with this, you know, that kind of DIY graphic design stuff from like the, you know, the early 80s, that kind of vibe into the distressed tones of the 90s, you know, like it's a kind of a cool melding of those elements.
Yeah. In the early 90s, I was, you know, in bands and friends in bands, and I was the, you know, the artistic one. So I was doing the flyers and t-shirts and all that kind of junk.
Was that your first sort of, I'm going to use the term loosely, professional, you know, work as, you know, in that
yeah.
sense?
Yeah, I did. I guess my first like real like published thing was a, you know, album cover.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what, like, how did you frame it in your head? Like, I remember getting my early, relatively unpaid, you know, jobs as a kid, and, you know, often it was like, well, you know how you can do this, so you do it. And then you're like, oh, okay, I'll do it. And you do it and you really don't know what you're doing. But there's this sense of like, I don't want to fuck this up. Like, I just don't want to fuck this up because everyone thinks I know how to do this.
Yeah.
Like, what was your mindset when like the band like said, do you want to do the cover?
I was like flattered and confused. And uh-huh. I don't think I had that, like, these are high stakes feeling.
I was just
like, oh, they want me to do this. I guess they figure I can do it, so I can do it.
All right. Yeah. I mean, it's probably a healthier engagement into it than life or death. But
I feel like now, like, I'm kind of like a art handyman in general. Mm-hmm. If somebody asked me to do something and I've never done it, I was like, I'll watch YouTube and figure out how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can learn how to do, if you have decent, what I would call hand skills, and that might be translated to just understanding how basic, you know, programs work on the visual end, which is the equivalent of hand skills. I think if you can have those, and if you've developed that sort of that 80% ability thing where you can get to 80% quickly, like, all right, I can get there and I can fake it, you know, and then like it doesn't take too long. Like, YouTube is like the king for helping that.
Yeah. I had a friend ask me if I could make a 3D comic, like that worked with 3D, like glasses. Mm-hmm. The red and blue. I was like, I probably could. So he had this art, and it was for, remember the Lost Boys movie?
I was just thinking about it the other day. Yeah.
There's a comic book in the movie that, you know, like maps out how they kill vampires. Yeah. It's just a prop comic, and it had never been published. And I had a friend who got the rights to publish it. You know, he got the art and he's like, can you help me do this? I'm like, hell yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I was doing all this research, you know, reading old, message boards and blog posts about how to make that work, and figured it out, and we did it.
That's badass. Do you have to strip it back to just being line art, or can you like, or can you just do some sort of field tones?
It was just black and white.
Okay.
And then, a cyan layer and a magenta layer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. Nice. And when did that come out and where?
I guess it came out like 5 or 6 years ago. Justin Ishmael put it out, and I think Bottleneck Gallery might have helped with that. He did a bunch of different versions. Like, I think he did a, like, we did a die cut cover and variant covers. And yeah, I would imagine they're probably pricey at this point, but
I would think,
probably,
yeah,
it's probably pretty limited, but I'm not positive.
You know, I love the movie when it came out, saw it, you know, a bunch of times in the theater, and
yeah, thanks.
But it just kind of vague, you know, it just kind of disappeared in my periphery. But then I just stumbled onto something, and there's like a huge fan base out there for this movie.
Yeah. Even for just like the saxophone guy.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's totally nuts. I mean, but it's cool. And I'm glad, because it's a very different, I mean, it is a different kind of movie. If you think about it in the terms of the genre, like, there isn't a vampire scene until like 40 minutes into the movie or something. So
yeah,
it's kind of cool.
It had a good vibe.
It did have a good vibe, good 80s vibes. It's pretty solid. So where you said 11 years ago to Charlotte, where did you move from?
We were in Maryland before that.
Oh, okay. Is that where you grew up?
I grew up in Maryland and DC.
Okay, cool. Well, that's a bit of a good music scene in DC, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I got really spoiled seeing a lot of great bands when I was a kid, and nobody comes to Charlotte.
Yeah, like, big acts come to Charlotte. Like, you get like a, you know, yeah, you get this sort of
like
the
arena, thing,
whatever, arena stuff, right, comes to Charlotte. And there, exactly, it doesn't seem to be. Yeah, I was.
We don't have like a small, well, we have a couple, but I think a lot of people skip it and do like the college towns in North Carolina.
Like, right, like Asheville, like, we get a bunch, right, of acts up here because we have,
yeah, I drove down there twice to see shows last year.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, I lived in Atlanta in the 90s, and it had a lot of great venues, yeah, to go listen to music.
Everybody plays Masquerade, or like the, yep, bands I want to see were always at Masquerade.
Yeah, Masquerade, Cotton Club, like, they were all these great places to go see tons of different, you know, acts. I think one of them is completely gone, and the other one might still be there. I don't know.
Yeah, Masquerade is still there.
Okay.
I played there in the 90s.
Yeah, right on, man.
My first trip to Atlanta.
So you were built. So you, I guess, you, do you think you kind of built up your pro chops making, you know, graphics for like your band and other bands? Is like that where it kind of blossomed?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
That and the other formative thing was getting a job at Kinko's, like, in 98, I think. Mm-hmm. That was the first time I had access to my own computer, really. That's where I learned Photoshop. I worked the overnight shift. I would get on AOL Instant Messenger, talk to other comic art people, and figure out how to do stuff.
Oh, that's rad. So there was an intention for the comics then. So,
yeah, I had always had a sketchbook, and, you know, we goofed around with comic stuff. I like coloring, but that's kind of what I tried to figure out in Photoshop, and that's how I got my start.
It was super confusing back then, you know, like. I mean, like, you know, let's all bless the multiply layer. But it was, you know, until you understood like how to like bitmap it properly and, you know, and then create that black line art, it was really like, I remember my old roommate and I, we would sit there and try to figure out, like, can we do this in Illustrator? Like, we were trying to figure out how to do the coloring, you know, in like the late 90s, 96 through 2000, we were just kind of banging our heads left and right, and we would send each other something here and there saying, you know, what do you think about this, you know, and rip apart each other's files and try to figure out how to do it better, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it was fun in that respect, and then I ended up teaching at a design school in the late 90s, so I got to learn Photoshop properly. Mm-hmm. And but still the multiply layer hadn't been invented at that point. So, and then when that came through, it was just, you know, oh, okay, this is so much easier. You know, comics are part of my earliest memories, like memories of like getting some comic books from my dad coming back from work or a trip or something. He, you know, and I still have, I think I still have at least two of the three that came. It was like one of those three packs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nothing name brand. It was like Dell Comics. And, you know, like there's a horror comic, a cartoony comic, and then like a fake superhero comic book. But like they were like the most amazing thing. But then there was also the Super Friends at the same time. So, right. Like, I understood like what Batman and Superman and Spider-Man were from the cartoons in the early 70s, but it was this sort of gateway thing. And then, you know, and then seeing Star Trek kind of filter in on like on reruns, like, oh, like there's more stories out there than just, you know, flying in a cape and punching something.
Yeah.
How did you stumble into them?
There was a 7-Eleven down the street from my grandmother's house, and she would send me to get stuff. You know, get milk. Mm-hmm. Here's money. Get yourself a comic and a Slurpee. The Slurpees at that time, you know, had the plastic cup with the superheroes on them. They had all these Marvel and DC Slurpee cups. So I don't know. That merch really got me.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember a Superman coloring book that I was pretty into when I would visit my grandmother down in Florida. But yeah, they're always like, you know, on the dashboard of my dad's truck, you know. Mm-hmm. Going to the beach or something. It's like Corn Nuts and comics.
Right. You already have an autobiography title. It's great.
When I was in middle school, I lived in walking distance to Jeffy's Comic World.
Oh, wow.
Which is like, you know, if you know about comics, like that's the guy.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the shop wasn't great, but you know.
Right, but it was a shop.
It was the first like all comic shop I had ever been to, and I was pretty into it.
Yeah, it is a mind blower when you first get to kind of walk into these spaces. I mean, they're these hallowed spaces, you know, record stores, you know, yeah, music shops, and comic book shops, all with great levels of attitude. But it's this cool kind of thing when you get to go in these spaces for the first time and then go like, oh, there's like, this is like all about this. It's not like going to the 7-Eleven where there happens to be comic books along with all this other stuff. Yeah.
And they're all in trash shape because everybody's in there and looked at them.
Sure.
But yeah. Speaking of like when we went to Masquerade, in Atlanta, like that was the first time I went to Criminal Records, and I was like, whoa, comics and records and me. Mm-hmm. Like this place is amazing.
Yeah. That place is still going. It is still going. It doesn't have the same vibe as it used to. But it's, I think they even have coffee there now. Like I think they've gone all the way in. But that place was great. Yeah, that was kind of like a cool, like Atlanta had a bunch of good comic shops, and they probably still do. But I remember, you know, moving there from New York City, and like just there's more of a footprint. So you get to walk in these shops, which like they're wider than 10 feet and they're deeper than 30. So you get to go, wow, this is huge. And just good stuff. But Criminal Records was that kind of cool thing where you could get a cool album of something that isn't over at Tower Records. And
yeah, I mean, I feel like every time we went in there, like we would all see something that we had never seen before, like whether mm-hmm. it's like an import record or some bootleg or, you know, weird zines from other countries.
It's unfair if you think about it to the sort of the creative collector, the financial burden that is thrust upon us at a young stages of our life where we can't afford all these things that we just have to have.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I don't know how many Scott Pilgrim pages I could have bought for $60
that I didn't. Right. Totally. I remember Adam Warren. He used to draw his pages on, you know, copy paper.
Yeah.
So he would just do it all in pencil. He didn't ink stuff. He would just use that.
Yeah.
And he just had like a box of these things. And yeah. He was like, you want, he's like, I don't know, like $10 a piece. Like, because he didn't really care as much. And, you know, and it was probably, you know, artist to artist kind of discount kind of deal. But I remember like, you know, getting a snagging a bunch of those things because I'm like, oh, cool. They were great to look at. I, you know, I no genetic crossover artistically with what he does, but it was just this beautiful thing to look at. And
buddy used to meet him. There was a anime show in Baltimore called Otakon, and I had never gone into Otakon, but I knew Adam Warren went there. So we like got in touch with him. We're like, can we meet you in the lobby and buy art from you? And he was like, yeah. Nice. So we would meet him every year in the lobby and buy art, commissions, you know, like those pages you're talking about.
Yeah, he's super genuinely like low key, and I don't know. It's when you meet these people, like his artwork is just crazy. You know, you look at it and it's just like so bombastic. And then you talk to him and he's just small batch brew loving guy, really like, you know, a Vermonter.
Yeah, for sure.
I love his stuff. So how do you like, so you're late 90s, I guess you're, you know, self-teaching Photoshop overnight in, you know, Kinko's with the aid of all the message boards that AOL had to offer at the time.
Yeah.
What was your sort of like, were you like planning anything? Like thinking like, oh, I'm going to go make something, do something? Or were you just accruing skills and looking for opportunity?
I definitely didn't have a plan. I probably still don't.
Nice.
Making cool stuff is like pretty much all I want to do. And mm-hmm. I guess I should have like a broader scope picture of like what that entails, but I don't.
Mission statement, make cool stuff. I mean, people like cool stuff.
Yeah. So I figured, I make a bunch of shirts and stuff. A few years ago, I had a bunch of them. I was like, oh, I should just collect these into a book and publish that. So I did that in 2019, you know, for people who missed the shirts, because, you know, you make a bunch of shirts and they're all gone. And unless you want to print it again, but then you have a bunch of shirts forever and that stuff. But they're making books and, you know, they sell out for some reason. So just this week I got kind of slow and I started making a sequel to that. You know, I've made a bunch of things in the meantime and had enough to fill a book. So started a new book and I should be finished with that next week if my daughter writes my foreword for me.
And as long as that art director doesn't respond to you while she's away on vacation.
For sure.
Damn work getting in the way of the things we want to do. Because there's a thing. And I really wish I had had that so long ago, at least as far as like the art stuff goes, that DIY thing. Like for me, DIY comes into the realm of making things, not making comics and that kind of stuff, because my mental line was, I make my work strong enough, Marvel and DC hire me and I get to make comics that way. That was like how I thought the route of making comics. But you know, like, oh, I like guitars. Maybe I can make a guitar, you know, or whatever the thing is. And that was kind of like but I wish I had more of that, you know, that sort of punk rock DIY kind of element, because it frames, and I'm sure working at Kinko's is a big boom for you in the terms of like, this is how it all goes together. Like, oh, that's okay.
Just growing up in DC, like, you know, there's a band called Fugazi and there was a big
scene. Never heard of them.
Bands that, you know, did their own thing, and that kind of stuck with me, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when I worked at Kinko's, I started doing like books for other people, like, you know, little ash can art books for people to sell at shows. And that, I feel like I was one of the first like people like doing that for people. And that really took off. You know, if you have a book from like the late 90s, then I probably stapled it. I was
folding and stapling
for San Diego. Like, I did all Adam Hughes' early books, Art Adams' early books. And then I got a job at another print shop, like running a real press and everything and doing pre-press over there. And that's when we started doing the color ones. Like, I don't know if you ever saw Adam's like big red one with Catwoman on the cover. We did that one over there. So yeah, I've had my hands in a lot of stuff.
Let's dive into that one a little bit. How did you line up, you know, with Adam in that respect? Like, did he get his hands on something that you had made and then was asked around, or?
That's a great question. I think we had some mutual friends. Selfreeze was one of the first people I met in comics. My friend Robert Joel, he was a big collector of art. I think that's benefited me a lot, actually, like collecting art. So jump forward, you know, I had a job at Heroes and I was doing the artist alley there. And, you know, just being an art collector, I knew all the artists and could kind of match up where they sat, you know, according to style and, you know, temperament. meeting people is like, I don't know how Adam, I know Eric Canetti, I did his early books. I met him on the optical resonance boards, just like a bunch of message board pals. Dave Johnson, website for him back then. Nice. Just like, you know, you do something and then people know you do a thing and then, you know, they seek you out, hopefully.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. I mean, when were the early Adam books? Adam and Adams. There you go.
Like 98, 99.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That makes sense, because it's so interesting, because the whole small business of being a comic creator now is so different than it was back then. Like and I'm sure, like, you can think it through. You know, if you think about, like, okay, like, there's a comic book world, but then there's the Ashcans in the zine world that sort of live right there at the edge of like mainstream comics. And you go, okay, I'm artist X and I can't do enough pinup drawings for a convention. Like, I just can't. Like, there's not enough time for me to sit there and draw Red Sonja 400 times or whatever it is. And, you know, and Adam sort of, you know, led the charge in that one. Like, I mean, not that anybody didn't want anybody's drawing before that, but Adam turned it into a business. But like, to have the sort of the clarity, whether it was a conversation of like, someone's like, well, you should just print a bunch of those things and then you could sell the book. Because at the time, the art reproduction on a sort of a small scale wasn't really high quality enough, like, to do a painted piece and then like do a color output. It didn't really look as nice.
Also super expensive to do, right? like a small run of something.
Yeah. So like, you could see that conversation of someone saying, oh, okay, Adam, you should do a small like ash can of a bunch of your pencil drawings. Oh, okay. And then like that question mark goes around, like, well, who does those, you know? Because like most people, especially of my generation and older, who didn't work at Kinko's, we don't know. Like, we know how to do comics by drawing on the page, sending the pages in to the publisher. So it's an interesting kind of thing. But like, you are, and it's funny because I really do think of you very much in the terms of like small business guy. When at the shows, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but like, for you to actually be there in that early stage, like, Glenn Murakami was always put out his little books, and I've always snagged his books.
Yeah, I always liked his and Ryan Del Carmen's.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember Shane had one. Yeah, those were cool.
Yeah, they're great. Yeah, and like, in, you know, Glenn did the smart, like, he did like the cool things, like he would have that little red, like, print chop that he would print out, you know, he'd stamp it on the cover, which just kind of gave it a really nice kind of like hand feel.
Yeah.
You know, and he would do he would do like that sort of that gray speckle tone paper for the cover, and then the interior would be.
Yeah, and that's like that kind of object is like totally what, you know, gets me going. It's what I like to buy, and it's like what inspires me.
No, I get it. That's like, I mean, it's a huge, I understand it. And like I said, I wish that rock and roll, you know, that punk rock DIY thing was there for me in my life. It wasn't at the time, you know, and because framing of how you do comic books outside of the mainstream is not easy if that's what your mindset is. And like today, it's different and it's relatively expected to make stuff and have a sort of a creative enterprise.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That's cool. Which is better?
I mean, there's no. All right, it's better when there wasn't all this stuff where you had to be distracted by it all day long. I mean, it was very nice to be able to kind of, you know, a phone call was your biggest distraction.
Right. Yeah. And, like promoting like stuff you make yourself it's rough.
It's so rough.
Especially if it doesn't have Spider-Man on it. It's such a bummer to like, you know, put your heart into something that isn't Spider-Man and, you know, no one cares.
For sure. For sure. And it's kind of now it's, I guess maybe it's a bit expected for you. So people are like, well, that's cool, but it's not Spider-Man stuff.
Yeah.
It does go back to that with that Howard Stern joke. If there's a movie that's really good and he'll go, is there Spider-Man in the movie? And people are like, no, it's and he's like, I don't care. And I think that, you know, it's kind of true in so many ways.
Why I keep saying that.
That's okay. He still is the most fun character. You started making these books, but are you making your own comic stuff, or are you like, no. you're still framing it as sort of like a production guy / sort of like, you know, toolkit designer for people looking for something.
Yeah. I'm like a serial collaborator. Like, I am like what you say, like, you know, I do my own thing, but collaboration just is more rewarding to me for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a bass player in a band. I am a colorist in comics, you know.
Right. Bass player.
Right. I just like, you know, facilitating, you know, what a more creative, artful person wants to get out there if I can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I go to a show and, like, I'll name names. I was at a show and my friend Louis LaRosa, it was the first time I had met him. I saw his artwork for the first time and I was like, holy cow, this is amazing. And he just had some like, you know, copy paper copies of his art like on his table and, mm-hmm. you know, no banner, no nothing. I'm like, Louis, my man, like people aren't going to be able to see this, like these copies laying flat on your table. You need to step up your game. So, you know, I tried to help him out as much as I could, you know, with banners, mm-hmm. and, you know, just trying to pass on to him what I learned from the kids at those anime shows, because anime shows have always been years ahead of like comic creators as far as like selling themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
dialing it back into the 90s again, and that's just where my experience begins. Artists didn't have prints of their own work. The right. people who were selling prints were the people who weren't doing pro work for, you know, publishers. They were just making drawings of Wolverine and Spider-Man and Batman and then just selling color copies of those things. And but those guys, and they still do, they have these gigantic like 10 foot tall, you know, right. walls of prints. And so I think there was kind of this for a long time, there was this sort of like
stigma.
yeah there was a big stigma to it. And then, I mean, maybe it was more in the line of like technology always kind of sways things. When things start looking really good, then people kind of like change their point of view on it. But the idea of maybe like having these artifact items that you were making along with others early on, like those kinds of things might change the sort of the needle in that sense.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Still think, you know, selling prints of copyrighted characters is kind of
it's so gray.
Yeah. So, but if they're in a book, it seems different. And I think it has to do with like, you know, that book's not all Spider-Man, you know, that book is, you know, a little bit from every job you've had or every mm-hmm. company you've worked for. So it's not as, you know, brazen, I guess.
I guess technically you can always get around it in the terms of if you put the word portfolio on that, because like the copyright holder can't stop you from promoting your work that you were hired to do using the same work. Like that you have the copyright legitimacy
they
to show that.
They could prevent you from selling it, I'm sure. If they wanted to pursue that.
Right, but yeah, and it was never in the best interest, it seemed, for any, you know, of, you know, let's say the big two to go around and shut everyone down for, because like it's almost free advertising in many ways. Like nobody is making, you know, and selling a Spider-Man comic book on the floor.
Right.
That's not through that, you know, through their licensing deal. It's straight up just a drawing at that point.
Yeah.
It probably gets a little gray with t-shirts.
Probably.
Yeah. All right. So you're in the 2000s and you're, I guess you're still in Maryland, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what's the, I mean, so you're rocking, are you still playing in bands at the time? Like,
no, I had stopped pretty much once I started working at Kinko's.
Okay.
And that's when I needed another creative outlet. So I figured out coloring.
Okay.
And I colored Beryl Dalrymple's first three pages of Pop Gun War. And I colored Still Freeze's Daredevil story from that black and white Marvel anthology.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought them to show Chiarello and Still Freeze.
Okay. Yeah.
Chiro liked it. Delfreeze said, I usually hate it when people do this because this was meant to be black and white, but I think he got something. And he said he didn't have time like on the floor, but we could talk like after the show. So after the show, we talked for, you know, about 2 hours, and he really, you know, gave me some good advice.
Yeah. What do you think, like, the top, you know, nuggets were for that advice from him?
I think focus color is something that he's big on, and echo storytelling, kind of, you know, something popping up in color and then repeating later in the story to kind of bring you back to that without consciously having to think about it for the reader. Another person who I met at SPX in Maryland, and Tomer Hanuka, and his advice was really good, like really helped, like shaped a lot of the way I worked. Is he said all my colors were too harmonious, and to add a color for tension, which is kind of the same as the focus color theory, but I think he was just more interested in, you know, tension and making it kind of more uncomfortable. And I mean, that's pretty much my main,
that's your main goal.
why do I feel like this when I'm looking at
this? Well, no, I can definitely see the distinction between the two. I mean, the focus color is it's a clarity factor. Like if you're trying to make a story understandable, legible, because art changes, like whoever you're doing it, you're not going to get the same thing. But you can do the same thing on different types of artwork in the terms of getting that clarity. And which, listen, that's what comic book coloring has always been about, is delineation. Like, this is a person, this is a chair. So I get that, but I think the color, it changes because it's sort of like grading in a film, where you're now trying to set a different sort of tone through how you've changing that sort of scene color.
Yeah.
Oh, somebody posted something, David Mazzucchelli stuff from one of his Daredevil runs that he did. And there's this scene of these sort of straight panels going across, and then there's a scene break at the bottom. So the bottom tier is just a two, you know, just two panels next to each other, but everything else is a linear thing. And everyone was like kind of going, because it was black and white, they're going, oh yeah, I mean, that's so, you know, so great to show how you break a scene by changing the grid up, and it's good. And I'm like, yeah, but also we're looking at black and white. Guarantee you, like, the discussion was color. Like, we changing the scene, we're going to change the complete palette, so it doesn't look like we're all in like the same sort of thing. Which,
yeah,
I mean, listen, color is like insane. Like, it, like, in the design realm, like, you have three things: you have shape, you have type, and you have color. And everything you do with those three elements is what you end up with when it comes to design. Like, there they are. And then, you know, and comic books are kind of the same if you think in the same terms. You have those three kind of elements. Like, now the color toolbox is way bigger than it used to be. And it's sorry. It's huge.
Yeah, I always make rules for myself, like limiting the amount of color. I think everything looks cooler when it's less colors.
Mm-hmm. When did you start employing that? When it was feeling like too much, or did you?
Oh, always.
Always,
yeah,
okay.
From the beginning, yeah. I think it's like concert poster design, probably.
Right.
Like screen printing.
Mm-hmm. Were you doing screen printed stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I was doing a bunch of t-shirts and stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, there is that limitation of color. You're like, hey, listen, this job can only afford two colors, or it can afford five colors. Like, those sort of external limitations, whether they're budgetary or, you know, just somebody else's selection.
Sometimes it's even like the shop you're going to, like, the guys aren't skilled enough to do, four color process.
Right. And then you're like, you know, and unless you want to embrace, like, make your design sort of structured enough that it can embrace sort of misregistration and overprinting, which is cool.
That's another thing. I would always hear about people, like, colorists being disappointed by print jobs and stuff. And I've never really had that. Aside from something not being as saturated as I would want, probably always, but like the color relationships are, no matter like how this comes out, like those are going to be the same.
Right. So
that's kind of what I tell people, is make sure your color relationships are good. And the printing can't mess it up.
Yeah. It's like legibility with color. Like, if you're printing colored type on a colored background, like, you need to make sure that you have enough distance in those two, so right, when they enter, you know, when you see it, you can see it. And I think that's like, and I think that's the same kind of idea, is that if you know what you're like, if everything is, because if everything is sitting in the middle and then it gets messed up, it's just a mud bath.
Yeah.
Well,
where'd it go?
Right. Yeah. See, I think that's so cool. So how do you go about making that choice? Because that's a conscious selection heading into something. Where do you budget that time in, and how do you kind of frame it?
I wish I could, you know, give you some like formula, but I'm very instinctual.
Uh-huh.
I don't have palettes usually to start with, and I kind of like, this thing has to be readable as this color, and then I kind of start from there and work out from that.
I mean, I guess with existing IP being, you know, the art of the characters, there's your sort of your baseline, and then how do you sort of build around that, I guess, would be the next kind of thinking.
Yeah. Just I want something, you know, the opposite end of the color wheel, usually, basically, is how I'll start.
Okay. Yeah.
And I don't know. Just, I feel like the thing that I don't like in other people's coloring is everything's important.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, yeah, you just need to, you know, knock the important stuff out of the park, and the unimportant stuff, you know, can just sit back and know, you don't want to. I work with a bunch of artists who are hyper detailed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I, you know, go and render every bottle in the background in a bar scene, it's not helping anyone.
Right.
It's not helping the reader. It's not helping the artist. It's like, you know, I think if I lay, you know, a flat color on, you know, that, then that drawing's still going to look great.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still going to read, you know, as a bar.
Right. Yeah. No, I get it. When you're saying that, I'm thinking, oh yeah, like that's the difference between, and I'm not bashing in case you happen to like this film director, but like a Michael Bay, you know, film, especially like the Transformers films that I've seen, I feel like I can't focus because
I've never seen one. I think, you know, from the stuff I've seen, it looks like piles of garbage fighting each other.
Right. Right.
So like when I was in the movie theater, you know, this year, and the trailer for that new one came out, and I'm mm-hmm. sitting with my wife, and I'm like, that's what it should have been all along. Like,
right.
They look like Transformers. Like, they don't look like, you know, piles of garbage. They look
right.
Like, nicely designed.
You experienced firsthand because you were working at Kinko's at the time, but the whole, what do they call it? The desktop publishing, you know, craze of the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, everybody, you know, the power of this is put into your hands, you know, and it was horrifying, you know, and, you know, in the mid 90s, when the digital coloring came into play, it was horrifying because the technologists are the first ones to get a hold of stuff, but they're not the artists. So they're like, it can do all this stuff. And you're like, we don't need all that stuff. We just need it to look really cool. And I think that, like, you know, the pile of garbage on the screen stuff is a result of that, where it's like, we can make all these little things and everything can move and it can be all lit and such. Meanwhile, if like Fincher directed it, it would be 50% of it's in shadow, you know, and you're only going to see what you need to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. It's
AI is like that right now. It's like, you know, people who don't know how to make art are using it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've seen a few artists who are using it and they're doing some amazing stuff.
Right.
Do you follow Ryan Hughes?
I know Ryan, yeah, but I'm not. Yeah.
Logo designs. You know, back mm-hmm. in the day, he did comics, but his AI stuff that he's been making is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I know it's a, you know, divisive subject, you know, for so many people, sure. Because there's a sense of like, oh, my theory is like, if you can remove money from the conversation of any subject, you can really talk about it.
Yeah.
But while money is on the table, people go like, well, I'm going to starve to death if I lose my position here. And so
or it's using my style to generate images for someone else.
Totally.
So totally.
Yeah, right. Totally. And like, I think, but the thing is, if I look at this or anything else, like, because listen, this argument was happening in the mid 90s when computers were being brought in to do coloring. And the colorists, you know, the traditional colorists were not happy because their livelihood was under siege.
Right.
Fast forward, you know, 25, 30 years, lo and behold, everybody's doing it in the same, using the same technology. The people who are doing it by hand are maybe 1% of the market. I mean, that's time. And you know, I hate to say it, but probably 25 years from now, like every comic book creator is going to be using some sort of AI-based tool. I mean, we already are. I mean, Photoshop is not, you know, bereft of AI. It is doing stuff. Hey, selection, click on that. You know, AI is making the selection of the human from that image.
Right.
So I think it's always like, listen, the creative people are always going to do interesting things with the tools, whatever the tool is when it comes along. And I think, you know, I think what we have to do is we have to be cognizant and protect the creators in the dissemination of the tool, because the thoughtless individual could be like, hey, I want to do a whole bunch of, you know, Spider-Gwen pieces, but in like the Rico Renzi style. And
I saw a whole Instagram account the other day. Like, I think somebody tagged me in it, and it's just like a alternate universe Gwen with brown hair. That's just like somebody just makes AI pictures of this character. And there was like 40, 50 little Instagram posts of this character. It's just
right.
So weird. I think it could be useful to show non-artistic people, you know, ideas before mm-hmm. you actually, you know, execute them. Because, we've all dealt with an art director or an editor who has no art background or understanding of things. And, you know, they need to see it to mm-hmm. understand what you're thinking. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, were I a guy who is making comic books as an artist now, I would try, you know, I would have my own sort of partition with my own artwork in there and start using that to help me develop things, you know, like based using only that as the information.
Like modern paste ups.
Totally. Right. Like have like my own morgue of my own stuff on there. And then like, hey, I need to have this be a football stadium. And it would go, okay, well, this is what it would look like utilizing whatever I'm gathering from what you've put in here.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I don't know. We'll see. I mean, it ain't going away, and it's everywhere. And that's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So you got this sacred information from Selfries and the idea of tension passed on to you. And what was like, so at this point, was it like asking around like, okay, now what do I do? Or did you like go hustle
I got a job really easy. Let me tell you. So I said, I built Dave Johnson's website, and
yeah.
I guess a mutual friend, you know, introduced me to Chris Brunner, and Chris Brunner needed a website. So he sent me a whole bunch of art, and that's what I would practice coloring on all the time. And Chris got a job drawing Legends of the Dark Knight for 5 or 6 issues. And we asked Mark Chiarello if I could color it. And mm-hmm. he said, no, because we don't know if you can hit the deadlines, but we like your stuff enough to do the covers. So let's do 6 covers.
Right so on.
Batman covers was my first gig. Pretty cushy.
Wow. Yeah, totally. I mean, enough to go buy some new sneakers. So that's pretty sweet.
Yeah. So for the first cover, I homaged Mark colors from The Plague of Frogs.
Mm-hmm.
From this one page, I just, you know, totally stole the palette and put it on a Batman cover. And I don't know if he knew it, but
right.
I wanted to pay my respect.
He's so, Chiarello is so great. Just.
Yeah. Big fan.
Oh, huge, huge fan. Like he was like, when he would do things going back in the 80s and you would see like his name grace something, it was like, you got to get it. Like,
yeah.
Because it's going to be different. It's going to be different than what he'd done before. Like it was all this kind of excitement of what he was going to put down on that page.
Yeah. I wish he was doing more covers right now.
Same. I bought
one last year. He did a cover for some book. Can't remember what the book was, but I remember the cover.
Nice. The more the better of whatever he does, because it's just, he's one of my all-time faves.
Yeah,
I think, and maybe, you know, not only just for his technique, I think it's the palette, like his eye for color stands.
Yeah. Got good taste.
He's got great taste.
DC misses him.
Yeah, I know. Listen, I don't, it's been in the wrong direction since they left Manhattan, but and not talking what they make, it's just on a creative level. Like, it's a very hard thing for that company to maintain their independence as a creative entity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I get it. I mean, I really truly hope that Marvel is cognizant of that and keeps them at least, you know, 3,000 miles away from Los Angeles. Cause it's very hard. Having worked in corporations, I just know how tough it is to stay somewhat autonomous when the, you know, marketing group is right down the hall.
Yeah.
Really hard to hide from them.
Yeah. I can't imagine.
Hopefully Mark will be doing something cool or is doing something very cool that we'll see soon enough.
Yeah.
So, all right. So you make a quiet splash dropping onto Batman covers. Did you make double time to try to get the covers in like immediately so Mark knew you were fast?
No, because I took forever on them. I didn't know what I was doing. Like, I feel like I didn't really know, you know, the basics of the technology. Like, I think the application of color was fine, but yeah, I wasn't comfortable with Photoshop.
Okay. Yeah, so what do you think was, looking back, like what was missing for you?
I mean, that was before I had a tablet screen. So, coloring everything with the mouse.
Nice. So
pretty much everything's flat. A lot of stuff now that I do is like turning lines in the color, like knockout, mm-hmm. but I didn't know how to do that then, like in an efficient way.
Right.
So anytime I did that, it was really tedious. Yeah. Now the guy I worked with on those, Chris Brunner, like he draws all the figures on one side of the page and flips the page over and draws all the backgrounds. So we have, they're a separate scan.
Mm-hmm.
So I can manipulate them separately.
That's really very nice on his half. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really impressive. I remember being blown away that Chris Sprouse used to draw his stuff on the back of the page and flip it over and then do the finished pencils through.
Yeah.
That's an accommodating artist for your work.
Well, I mean, I think we both look at it like as, you know, I mean, we try to make it look as close to one person making it as possible. Mm-hmm. Like, so, I don't know, we're kind of thinking of the product at the very beginning.
Right.
More than, you know, like typical assembly line comic. Mm-hmm. We talk about a bunch of stuff, you know, before the pencils even start usually. So it's a rare, like, collaborative.
Right. but clearly that's an important aspect to you. I mean, you mentioned it before. So, I mean, it's valuable. I mean, was this like that conversation to where this, you know, unique way of doing a page kind of came up? Like, was that something you guys just talking and figuring it out? Like, his going like, man, you really are always changing, you know, the backgrounds, you know, the lines in the backgrounds or in the characters. Like, do you want me to do this? Or would you like me to do that? Like, was that kind of thing? Or was it
I don't think he asked. I think he just did it.
Oh, wow.
He was coloring his own stuff like prior to all that. So I think he kind of, I mean, he understood Photoshop better than me. So
mm-hmm.
He knew how everything worked and what would make things easier.
Yeah. I mean, listen, everybody, it doesn't matter whether you're penciling it, inking it, coloring it, lettering it, you know, you are underskilled when you're starting. Like, nobody's walking in there capable of doing what they want to do to the level that they would hope it would be. So, like, how did you frame it in your head and go, okay, I need to do X, Y, and Z? Like, did you think like, okay, did you take time and go, how do I make this better? How do I get to where I want to be? Or did you just...
I think every project, you know, I would try to learn a few new things.
Okay.
I feel like I've been going through my whole life just building, you know, a toolkit and mm-hmm. you just, you don't know when you're going to use these skills.
Yeah. You can do it. Were you reaching out? Like, was this like, when was this, like 2005-ish around there?
Yeah, this is 2000.
Okay. Okay. So really early. So were you just like reaching out to chat boards, like to try to like.
Yeah. Message boards. Mm-hmm. Like the Shanglines drawing board was a thing. Optical resonance was a thing. I don't know. Gutter Zombie is like just a colorist board that came out around that time.
Okay.
I don't remember if that one was a thing yet. I think there was one other, Pencil Jack. I didn't really hang out there much, but Pencil Jack was pretty good for information.
Right.
But I just pick up things. Like I would see something that somebody did and I would ask, you know, specifically, you know, how'd you mm-hmm. do that?
Right.
And, you know, some people are like, that's my secret. I can't tell you that. And some people are like really generous. Like,
yeah.
You know, Selfreeze is like, he's my model for, mm-hmm. you know, if somebody asks me something, like, I'm going to take the time to explain this to you as best I can. Like, I can't explain as well as him, but I will try to help somebody if they are stuck on something or want to figure out a technique.
Yeah, he really is a consummate like educator within the industry.
Like the way he can quantify something, like turn mm-hmm. it into words that I don't know. Just like he'll see something that, you know, it's just kind of a blob and you don't really understand it. And then he'll be like, oh, that's blah 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 blah. I'm like, oh, right. That makes sense.
Well, I guess he might be coloring for clarity when it comes to talking. Like he's just he's highlighting the subject that you need to be paying attention to.
Yeah, for sure.
Among that blob. Like most people are really kind of cool about like sharing the information to get, I don't know. I mean, I remember like working in a design firm and there was a guy there who had just been doing it a lot longer. He was same age, but he just had all this, you know, these years of experience. And I would just go into the server and I would pull make copies of his files and just tear them apart because I'm like, how did he do this to this and get this, you know, in an Illustrator file? And, it's the best thing to be able to get your hands on someone's like a working file.
Yeah.
I did a variant cover for Crossover mm-hmm. a couple of years ago and D Cuniff, he was doing this halftone, really sort of like oversized halftone effect on his cover artwork for the series. And I'm like, I want that. You know, like that's what I want to make it sure it look like. So I was like, hey, how do you do this? And he just sent me the a cover file. He's like, here, you know, you can just get the settings from here. Like he had was just made it easy in that sense. So you were basically sort of autodidactically making your way from not knowing how to structure your pages. Did you get a tablet soon after? Like what was the...
Trying to think when I got my first tablet. It was... I know the artist I was coloring on it, but I can't remember the year.
Okay.
It was Toby Cypress. It was a 4-issue thing called Killing Girl. And I had, I got my first, like, you know, the little, like 12-inch Wacom Cintiq.
Mm-hmm.
Like I had the, you know, the Wacom tablet that you put
the Intuos.
I suck at those. Like I ended up like I had two of those and I just ended up not using them
mm-hmm.
unless I really had to, you know, draw something.
I have one in the closet. If you want it, I'll drop it off next time I'm down in Charlotte.
I am good.
Okay.
Yeah, I hate those things. But yeah, it just like the tablet sped me up so much.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, and it was the first time I could, you know, make, you know, draw on a page. And, you know, Toby's stuff is real, you know, expressive. So I was able to kind of make the colors have that same kind of vibe and not just, you know, my regular flat, you know, color in the lines type stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I was able to make it more painting.
It's so interesting how transformative you think about it. I mean, it's easy to go, oh yeah, of course, the Cintiq really changed the way comic book artists draw comic books. You know, like, okay, sure, you can draw directly into the computer and make your book and never have to, you're skipping some steps. It's great. But the transformation, like, listen, the programs are amazing in the coloring end, but what you can do with a Cintiq versus an Intuos and let alone a mouse, it's light years.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Were your files a mess? Like, were you like, were they just like layer, or did you have a system?
It always depended. Like, if I know somebody's going to see it, like see the file, then I'll, mm-hmm. And I've never been like tons of layers. I was talking to Chris Sotomayor. He's one layer. He's like, mm-hmm. Line art, and then everything else is, all the colors are just on another layer, like one layer.
That's crazy.
Like that seems crazy to me. But I've seen people who are super, you know, way crazier than me, like a million layers.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like, you know, usually like 7 is probably the max.
Okay.
Unless it's like, I don't know, for a comic page, it could be less, like 4 or 5. But like covers are usually more, I don't know, if I'm doing like design stuff on them too.
Yeah, yeah. You're gonna. I mean, it's your showcase piece. You get to kind of do some fun stuff. But yeah, I mean, I look at, you know, Matt Hollingsworth's page layers, and he's just got like all these things happening in there. I'm like, God bless him. You know,
that's surprising. He's a lot of layers.
Yeah, he used to have a whole bunch of videos up on YouTube years ago. And it was quite.
I watched his gradient map video was helpful.
Mm-hmm. Everyone loves a good Matt Hollingsworth gradient map video. I mean, they're wonderful.
I recently colored a Louis LaRosa Transformers cover, and every little piece of robot is its own gradient map.
Really?
Yeah, that one is a lot of layers. Like that one is a lot of layers in folders.
Mm-hmm.
Optimus Prime folder, you know, 30 layers. RC folder, 30 layers.
And is that just sort of like a personal, like, I'm gonna go like all in, and like regardless of whatever the budget is?
It just seemed like the best way to do it.
Right.
I don't think I could ever color him like on interiors. Like, mm-hmm. doing a cover, yeah, it's like, I don't care how much I'm getting paid for this. I did ask for a raise on it. Like, I asked for more money than they were offering it, which they agreed to. So I was like, well, they're in, I'm in.
All right, good. Yeah. Do you feel that you would be compelled to overwork the interiors if that was the case?
No, it's just, it would take too long. I don't think I could finish it.
So you go broke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the main reasons I color comics and don't do something else is because I can do them pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that would defeat purpose.
Right.
Like,
no.
Like with Sienkiewicz ink.
Right.
Like, I can ink a bunch of comics for a quick payday.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you got the skills and you can do it without it really just sort of impacting your day, then yeah. No, that makes complete sense. That's a great analogy, the Sienkiewicz inking. I love it. It's the truth. All right. So creative enterprise, like, you know, there have been more than a few people who have sort of pointed your direction, either verbally or physically, when it comes to like your tabling at a show. And it's funny, and it's fun because I think when I first bumped into you at Heroes a couple of years ago, you were just setting up. Mm-hmm. And then I think when we were together at Beer City, you know, we were both in the morning and just setting up. So I was like, like you have a very, very like thoughtful presentation.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, yeah. And to me, that's like you are a shop a shopkeeper in that sense. Like you are thinking about how this is all going to go together versus just I've got a bunch of prints here and I got it. Like it's all, everything has a place rather than like fighting for table space.
Yeah. Shopkeeper, merch table, at a concert. Mm-hmm. I think that's where that comes from. I just remember like being on the road and running out of shirts, but we had a bunch of patches. So we went to a thrift store and they had a bunch of windbreakers and we bought all of their windbreakers and sewed patches on them all day and made our biggest profit that night ever.
Wow.
But yeah, that's my background. I don't know. So just, I mean, there's the people that come by and want you to sign their book and they care about you, but you know, 90% of the people at the show are just walking around looking for what catches their eye or what character they like. So, I mean, a bunch of them, you're not going to break through because if you don't have, you know, Zelda, then they don't care. Like they're there for their specific thing. But, you know, if I feel like my table is always like, you know, will draw people over, even if, you know, it's not necessarily their thing. So I can chat with them for a minute and, you know, tell them what I make and, you know, see what they're into. And maybe I have something that is adjacent to what they're interested in, or maybe I don't. Maybe I just give them a card and, you know, they go and look at my dumb shirt and buy one later.
Yeah. But I think your setup is like that. Because it's not, listen, you're not stacking comic books for sale. Like you don't have like, you know, like I think you were sitting next to, or at least close by to, you know, Matt Manning. He looks like a bookstore, you know, like Matt's got like 50 different things on his thing. It's like he's a miniature Barnes and Noble and it's fantastic. I mean, his table was bowed from the weight of all his books. And, but that's a different experience. Like he is selling, you know, the wear of that sort of the result of the work. And you're creating kind of like intentional products for people who are cruising these floors because they're not all comic book readers. And if they are, maybe they're going to go to the comic book writer or artist of those books to get the thing versus you, like you're kind of number two or three in that list.
Right. Yeah. Figuring out how to table as a colorist has been a journey.
Yeah.
I mean, for years, I've always made cool stuff. Like I'm not going to like be modest. Like even when I wasn't, you know, coloring Spider-Gwen and a popular colorist, like I was still making, me and Chris would make cool stuff and bring it to shows and no one cared.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so it's like, you have to figure out how to make it, you know, make it so that your table is giving off a vibe that people want to visit.
Right.
So yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the years of
trial and error.
Failing, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's like, you know, you were saying about the t-shirts, like everybody wants to make a t-shirt, you know, like that's this sort of like, oh, we can make a t-shirt. You're like, yeah, you could. And you could also have a lot of t-shirts in your house because they just sit around forever. Like it doesn't matter what they are. Like they are just going to sit around. Yeah.
Do you want to know my t-shirt advice for everyone out there?
Yeah. Hit it.
Okay. So, do a pre-order. If you think you have a great idea, do a pre-order. And then just use the money that you get from your pre-order to buy some extras to bring to shows. But that way you have free shit. And if you want to throw them away because they don't sell for years, then you can.
Yeah. No.
Like you've made your money. You broke even.
It makes sense. So what's going on for, like, so you're I guess you're waiting for pages to come in. The job of a colorist.
Yeah. Nice. I just got some pages for Once Upon a Time at the End of the World.
Oh, cool.
The current book I'm working on with Nick Dragata and Jason Aaron.
That's nice. That's awesome. Are you enjoying it?
yeah, it's a lot of fun. Like cool. The world is on fire in this story, so mm-hmm. everything's pretty much red.
Solves that problem. There you go. And then you have the opportunity to change the color if you want people to go know something is different.
Yeah. They went underground and it was blue for a minute.
Okay.
Yeah. That's cool. I like the book. But the book's cool. It has a good conceit for using multiple art teams.
Okay.
There's three different art teams, and each art team illustrates the era of these people's lives. So the story started out when they were kids, and then they were adults, and we're doing the old people versions when the world is destroyed.
So, that's what I think about when I think about you, old people stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So what are you making for your Christmas meal? Anything special?
Oh, no, I don't know.
I know you like food.
Maryland. I heard talk of steaks. So
I guess Christmas steaks.
Yeah.
All right.
That's cool. Talk about food. I just prepared two frozen meatloaves that I will put on the smoker tomorrow. Yeah.
So you put it on, you make the loaf, you freeze it, and then you smoke it for the day.
Yeah. I wrap it in plastic, stick it in a loaf pan, get that mm-hmm. shape, put it in the freezer. So it's just a big brick of meat.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put it on the smoker and it gets the crust all around every side.
It sounds great.
Exciting.
I love it. Yeah. Well, I don't know how it is for you down there, but our ethnic food is not great up here in Asheville. We don't have a lot of ethnicities up here. Okay. So it forces me to become much more fluent with, you know, cooking different foods from around the world.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I love doing it. So, but we're going up to New York City for Christmas. So I don't think I'll be doing a whole lot of cooking because we'll have all the good food there. Though I do cook a full English breakfast usually at Christmas time.
That's fun.
Yeah. That's always a good hit with the missus. All right, dude. Well, people can find you through the links in the description. Anything you want to toot? You're such a big horn tooter. It's your nature.
I guess keep an eye out for that self-published book of dumb things called Seriously, I Don't Get It, coming soon.
Okay. So coming soon. Go follow him wherever the links are in the description, and then you'll know when it's coming out, maybe.
Thank you, sir.
All right, Rico. Thanks for taking the time, buddy.
Yeah, man. Bye.